This is Dr. Z, Zachary Brooks, and this show is called The People Behind the PhDs. This is Dr. Z, Zachary Brooks, and welcome to part 3 of the interview with Dr. Tariq S. Bell-Bahar, who studies altered states of consciousness and cognitive affective processes at the New York State Psychiatric Institute in the Washington Heights neighborhood of Manhattan, New York City. There's a few seconds of overlap, so we can pick up right where we left off in The People Behind the PhDs story. So yeah. Then now you're at Oregon, starting your PhD. What are your thoughts at this point? Because we're still not quite there with the things you're studying. I mean, all your background is fascinating, but what were your thoughts entering into the PhD program? I'm going to study X, Y, and Z, or is it this very general?
Right.
Very general thoughts, like, I really like psychology, and it's fascinating to me, and I'm reading all these books, but did you have, like, particular interests?
Sure. I mean, basically, I wanted to continue the work that I had started as an undergrad, and to extend it or connect it with other research labs, if possible. And, I mean, what I ended up doing, a bunch of my own experiments. I mean, I stayed in grad school for like 7 years,
okay,
as opposed to the normal 4. So I took most of the classes. I TA'd for most of the classes. I ran a lot of essentially studies I didn't need to do and eventually didn't publish on. But again, kind of doing a lot of experimentation. Basically, we had a pool of university students that we could easily ask to come in and do computer tasks. And it was kind of cool as a grad student, too, to be like, oh, yeah, I'm running my extra studies, da-da-da-da. But, of course, if we had published on them, it would have been even better or more productive. So I came in as a personality assessment in the personality and social psychology part of the program, which usually the psychology departments have like 2 or 3 or 4 divisions, and you kind of come in on one of these tracks as part of the yearly gaggle of grad students that they select to come in. And usually these folks have posters that they've taken to conferences, which is something that I did. I went to 2 sets of conferences. I think it was the Western Psychological Association one time, and then the other time the American Psychological Association, or the Society for Personality and Social Psychology meeting. So I think I had a pretty good setup for getting into grad school, having run my own experiments, having a firm grasp of what the field was generally about, still being kind of pretty starry-eyed. Eventually, I got more jaded. It still looks like the problems of human behavior can be solved, maybe when you're entering grad school, and perhaps one should be less romantic about all that.
Yeah.
And just kind of get through grad school, because it's kind of, you're getting certified in a sense, and the main goal of grad school is essentially to run a project from A to Z, or 2, and get them published, and do kind of dissertation phase, which is kind of maybe like a third, more final project. And, you know, for some people it rips them apart, for some people it's real easy, they just kind of breeze through it. I knew someone who got through in like 3 years or so.
Wow.
We were like, where did she go? And she's like, I'm working now. I'm getting paid. I'm out of grad school. Whereas some other folks stayed around for a while. And I guess it also totally depends on what kind of funding you get and whether the program is paying for you to be a TA or an RA, what the extra, essentially, what's taking care of your housing and lodging. And in my case, and this is a general other caveat too, is I think I took out too many loans and I still haven't had a chance to pay them all back, and it's been a kind of a burden from that period. But I don't know, if I looked at academic wages, I would have seen that you really don't get into six figures as a faculty member until basically you've killed a few other professors. No, I'm just, you've advanced enough in your department and so on. I mean, essentially, when professors get to, like, having been on a grant or having been a principal investigator in their projects for, like, let's say 15-plus years, then they're already in the kind of 125-plus figure range. And that's more for, like, research professors. Then endowed professors are probably talking about something else. It really depends on what kind of caliber scientist you are, what you're working on. I have friends who, from grad school, who interned at Facebook in some kind of personality assessment stuff back when it was like just 2 years old. They've been with them since, with the company since. Another friend came in focusing on depression, and essentially has a professorship, but where the focus is more like depression and inflammation. Hmm. There's, I don't know, other people who work at Google, other people who have their own startups, other people who are like more traditional professor types.
Sure.
On the professorship. And between all of us, there's only one or two kind of stars, you know, or like folks who are like renowned in their field. What I'm trying to say is that there's few geniuses and a lot of librarians, and both are important.
Wow, that's a nice expression. So the way I started off the show today was talking about three things that you like to research the most. So altered states of consciousness, paranormal psychology, and neuroscience of mysticisms. Can we talk about each of those for about 5 minutes each? Can you talk about altered states of consciousness?
Sure. I mean, in my work with brain dynamics, especially as measured through EEG, and based on kind of learning to work with EEG in graduate school, the research I've done has basically always involved EEG of one kind or another, examining cognitive states of one kind or another, whether it was when we look at emotional faces, when we're moving around, when we're solving cognitive problems, or in other cases, when someone's has a subesthetic ketamine dose and is potentially having an altered state, a meditator is doing their meditation, or a shamanic healer is doing their shamanic healing. So it kind of, my interests and experiences have kind of, and the opportunities I've had to work on have cut across various kinds of cognitive states, the rainbow of cognitive states, so to speak.
Mm.
And I would consider them, all of them, altered states. But I think what...
So you would consider every state an altered state. It's just altered from a state that it was previously and a state that it will be at some point. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, it has something to do with this kind of... Maybe it's an inane idea, but of like things of being oscillatory and perturbable and how we're kind of shifting from state to state. But I mean, let's just say a few things. There's certainly been a resurgence in consciousness science over the last, let's say, 20 years. It's a pretty diverse topic area with a lot of diverse kind of workers. There's also been a kind of so-called psychedelic renaissance, with a lot of work on ketamine in altered states, but also more recently other psychedelics. And both of these areas certainly need decades or more of research before really knowing what's going on and whether we can have treatments based on various psychedelic substances, or whether different models of consciousness are correct, one or over the other. I guess they're kind of two different questions, but theories of consciousness and where they're going, there may also be hundreds of years of work there to do, and it may be really about the kind of ultimate questions about human mind and how we can simulate and recreate human minds and so on, which may be a really like a long-term goal for the psychological sciences, which are, they're so young. Only about 100 years old.
So jumping from altered states of consciousness, what about some of your interests in paranormal psychology? And first of all, can you define that for people? I think altered states of consciousness, the average person can understand, but paranormal psychology, I think, you know, some people think they might understand that, but how would you do, you know, what's a clinical or at least a accepted definition of paranormal psychology?
Sure. Well, the clinical definition is basically that it's a psychiatric syndrome. If someone's having some kind of paranormal experiences, and it could also be a basic cognitive trick that people play on themselves. Regardless, paranormal psychology is not something that should be just thought negatively of just because mainstream science thinks that way. I think there's been over like 100 years of pretty steady, if not necessarily high quality research on so-called psychic phenomena, mediumship, out-of-body experiences, things like that. In fact, kind of the birth of psychology is kind of really connected to also the birth of psychical research. Where I come from, there's the Society for Psychophysiological Research, SPR, but there's also a Society for Psychical Research that's been around since like the late 1800s. In paranormal psychology, there's a lot of bias against it in mainstream science, because it basically doesn't, a lot of the claims from paranormal psych don't fit in with mainstream physicalist science, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So it's a difficult topic in some ways, but to be brief, I had some opportunity to work on some studies related to mediumship and altered states. I mean, also in other projects with whether it's ketamine or meditation or shamanic healing.
You said you'd had a chance to work with various, you said ketamine and some other things.
And before that?
I forget what you said before that.
Okay. Let's just retrace for a second. Paranormal psychology, it has been under attack, but may have a lot to offer. And just to sum it up, look, it doesn't matter whether, if you're a psychological scientist, if you're interested in the human mind and behavior, it absolutely doesn't matter if the person that you're studying, the human that you're studying, thinks they're communicating with a ghost, as in a medium. That's totally fine. It doesn't matter that there may not be any ghosts, and that it may be a delusion on the participants from the person's mind. They may literally be making it up, or have a psychiatric problem, or have some kind of brain injury. But who knows? But what I'm trying to say here is that it's intrinsically interesting because it's human behavior.
Yes.
And we need to understand like more about the broad spectrum of human behavior, both normal states, altered states, accepted states, delusional states, whatever. We have a lot of cartography left to do.
Of all the states, yeah.
Yeah, let's not be so judgmental. And I think in the end, things that are about apparitions, that are really just, endogenous apparitions, then we'll sort that out too. And it's okay if we find new knowledge when studying at the edges of accepted science. That's okay. Let's integrate it eventually, and let's just make sure there's enough evidence that it's replicable, that we're not just chasing phantoms, so to speak, of empiricism.
Stories. Stories are humanity's original technology, so I'm proud to carry on the traditional technology and share this story with you. Whether you're on an iPhone or an Android, whether you're on Apple, Spotify, or another podcast service, whether you're at home, in your car, at work, on public transportation, working out, or just walking around, I dedicate my shows to you. Dr. Z Productions and Podcasts, Consequential Stories for Life. Yeah, absolutely. So the next item that I introduced you by was neuroscience of mysticism. So what is neuroscience of mysticism?
It connects to consciousness science. It connects to, because a lot of ancient models of mysticism deal with consciousness, and levels of consciousness, and changing consciousness. And it relates to altered states because humans do altered states, humans do religion, humans do ritual, humans do trance. There's just like all these things about what we as a species do across cultures that relate to, for lack of a better word, a propensity to have religious experiences. And there's also like this kind of tradition within religious practices that sometimes comes under the umbrella term of mysticism, usually having to do with some kind of access to an ultimate reality or ultimate being or the deity, but somehow like the having to do with the core of the religious experience.
Sure.
From my perspective as a psychological scientist and someone who has been interested in spiritual practices from around the world that I just studied on my own time and tried to experience some of them, it's a fascinating topic. But religious experience itself hasn't been studied from, let's say, a neuroscientific or neuropsychological point of view very well or programmatically or systematically as of yet. And one could say that, we have about 100 or 200 years of anthropology about religious experience. Yes, we do. We have a kind of interesting models in the psychology of religious experience that we do based on self-report and behavior. But we don't have something like the nervous system and the body, what it does during various kinds of religious experiences, religious rituals, or even mystical experiences. And mystical experiences just fall under kind of extreme, as a kind of class of extreme contemplative or religious cognitive states, which certainly include the body and certainly include a context or an environment, and certainly include a history to that context. But it's an experience that happens in a person, and there's a lot more work to do to kind of get at the dimensions of religious, of mystical experience, of contemplative experience, of meditative experience. There really hasn't been like a strong link between the ancient models of meditation from all kinds of traditions, including kind of Judaic ones or monotheist ones, not just Asian traditions. So there's a lot that we could learn from studying religious experience in general, as well as intense religious experiences, which would fall under the general label of mystical experiences. And all of these are kind of like telescopes into the mind. Mm-hmm. It's, again, just like the person studying the talking to a ghost, or perhaps not. This is a way to just get at a clearer picture, a profile of the psychological, brain level, body level dynamics that are kind of occurring during experience X. I don't know.
Sure.
I've always.
So one of the things that it's stood out in your conversations about these three topics is the real focus on behavior, you know, human behavior, and how it's not been mapped out completely. I don't think you used the word mapped, but something like cartography. You know, you have the sense that there's an expanse of human behavior, and we don't know all of that behavior. And if we do know it, we don't appreciate it because we haven't studied it fully. And you also kind of referred to this being a very fairly young science. So my final question for you is to think about the year 2119, 100 years from now, and where do you see, you know, two or three trends for the psychological sciences you're interested in, somewhere between altered states of consciousness, paranormal psychology, and neuroscience of mysticism? Where do you see things going in the next 100 years?
That's kind of a cool exercise. So by that time, there should be implantable or nano devices that record internal body activity and brain activity, kind of streaming it continually. That should be possible. I think like people in their homes will most likely have some kind of boxes that do assessments of them. It's kind of like an AI doctor/therapist that...
slash coach, maybe, huh?
yeah. And you could keep your data proprietary to build up your own AI's knowledge of you, to optimize yourself. That sounds kind of a little bit too, it's like being your own big brother. But anyway, hopefully there's a lot of issues surrounding health that have to do with behavior control, behavior choices.
Absolutely.
Driving unsafely or smoking or other eating choices and so on. And if there was some way we could kind of get to understanding group behavior and individual behavior, then we could at least control some of it and help diminish some of the suffering So I'm definitely for kind of like a socialist psychological utopia, where like the psychological scientists are the kings.
Okay. And where
the
would
the kings and queens?
The kings and queens of the world.
Yeah, like Plato's book, The Republic.
Yes.
Yeah. So, but we certainly we could use more humans, like Vonnegut said. You know, we don't need bigger brains, just like giraffes don't need longer necks.
Mm. We just need to use our brains better. Yeah.
Sorry?
We just need to use our brains better. That's the idea.
Sure. Well, or that our brains are cumbersome in the sense that they provide too much computing power.
Hmm.
You know, you kind of overthink it or get caught up with the past and future scenarios. but yes, planning is good. And having a neocortex is nice. It at least makes for a richer experience, apparently.
So in 2119, you see an AI box in everyone's house that helps coach you to better behavior and monitor where you've been and where you might go and what choices you might make to perfect a behavior to get you a better result, whatever that result is directed towards. That's what you see in 100 years. Okay.
I mean, that's part of it. I mean, maybe things would have a radically different feel, you know, if global warming is real and the sea levels do rise, maybe people will be doing this on cities in the sea or sea scrapers, you know, or underground or something like that. I guess I wish there was more concentrated world economic effort that was kind of diverted to education and science and kind of, I guess, human welfare.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of good work could be done. I think, like, the as a species, we have a long way to go, and it'd be nice to see all the important research that needs to be done.
Well, yeah, that's
so,
go ahead.
No, please.
Well, I was just thinking that was a nice place to end. I mean, just this uplifting thought that there's a lot more we can do to improve the human species, and if we took massive effort at various levels, governmental and elsewhere, directing resources in that direction, we can actually do a lot more for our species. That's kind of your underlying theme in many ways.
Yeah, I mean, if there's anything... So, look, the doctorate may be dead. It may not be important now. The scholastic academic system might be crumbling in various ways. Education, or at least some kind of core current college curriculum, is like a whole democratization of it, right? Who knows if getting a doctorate is key, but some kind of love of learning, love of exploring, certainly helped me to get through. Your last question was?
That's it. You answered my last question. I was asking about 2119 and what the world would be like, and you answered that question. So thank you.
Sure. I will probably still be stuck on the planet, and it would be nice if people devote their life energy to science as a force for good, as much as possible in this context.
Good. Well, thank you for being on the show today, Dr. Tariq Bel-Bahar, Man of the Ocean. So have a good afternoon, and we'll talk to you soon.
All right, thanks. I appreciate it.
All right, bye-bye. Thanks for listening to part 3 of the interview with Dr. Tariq S. Bel-Bahar, who investigates brain dynamics and the neuropsychology of mystical experiences. To continue listening, visit drz.net. That's dr-z.net. You can also follow me on Facebook at Dr. Z Podcasts and Instagram at drznet. As always, happy deciding. The People Behind the PhDs is conceived, written, produced, and edited by Dr. Z, that's me, Zachary Brooks, PhD, in Dr. Z Productions and Podcasts. Learn more at drz.net/about. That's dr-z.net/about.